Welcome to the Musings on Sports podcast. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my good friend and co-host, Bob Bupka. Hey, Bob, I know both of us had a lot of positive feedback about our very first episode, which featured our special guest and our good friend, the great Jim Nantz of CBS Sports. I got to tell you, my friend, it was a lot of fun, and I think the focus on quality storytelling really resonates with people, Bob.
I think you got a good point there. You know, as much as the people enjoyed listening to the stories, I know you and I both enjoyed telling the stories. It seems to be in our blood. Lots of fun with Jim Nantz. Tell your friends about Musings on Sports. We're going to continue that format. We're going to dig deeper and deeper for various stories and make it the best darn podcast you could listen to. And hey, let's move on here. In the interest of expedience, a couple of things on the golf scene that we have to talk about, Kelly, and that is, number one, Phil Mickelson will not be playing in the Masters.
Bob, I sat next to Phil for many years when I moderated press conferences for the PGA of America, and while Phil was always accommodating, there was no question that you got the sense of, just from those interviews at the PGA Championship or at the Ryder Cup, that Phil was always kind of, at least in his mind, the smartest guy in the room. And we all make decisions in life, Bob. And obviously the decision that he made to align himself with the Saudis through the LIV they're gonna start playing in June, but that tour has come back to haunt him and bite him in ways that he could never have imagined. And I think on top of everything, when he had Rory McIlroy and some other players do something where you never have, ever have fellow players take shots at you, that was something that has led, I think, to him having a lot of soul searching. And part of it is making the decision not to play in the Masters. And I'm presuming as well, likely a month afterwards, not to be the defending champion at the PGA Championship.
We brought up a good point there, Kelly, in that it was Phil's decision. As a former champion at the Masters, you're on the automatic invite list. Now, nobody can take you off that list except yourself. Phil Mickelson obviously opted to be removed from the invitation list, and he will not be playing at the Masters. And good golly, Kelly, you know, with all the money that Phil has already, why would he want to give up another opportunity to play in the Masters when he could win the Masters? I mean, he wins the PGA a year ago. He knows how to play Augusta National. I'm just flabbergasted. I'm friends with Amy, his wife, and been around Phil for quite a while. I hope he's happy. I'm going to leave it at that. If Phil's happy, then I'm happy for Phil. I know golf fans everywhere are not happy. What I want to ask you about, though, Kelly, also the European Ryder Cup powers-to-be have tabbed none other than Henrik Stenson, former Open champion, to be the next Ryder Cup captain for the European side. Your take on that selection?
I think it's a decent pick. I think that Lee Westwood, Bob, clearly was the front runner for that position as the captain of the 23 team for the matches to be played outside of Rome. Westy took himself out of the running for a number of reasons. Stenson, great track record as far as a player. I think he'll be a good captain. The challenge he's going to have, very clearly, and you can see with the likes of Sam Burns winning at Valspar over the weekend, you have so many good young American players, and now they've won the Ryder Cup, and now that puts a lot of positive energy into you, and the Europeans seem to be in transition in terms of I don't know how to say it best, but to own the Ryder Cup once again. I don't think that's going to happen for a while. However, all that being said, the fact of the matter is the United States has not won the Ryder Cup in Europe, Bob, as you well know, since 1993. And this is not going to be a one-sided crowd like you had up in Wisconsin, where there were very few Europeans there because of COVID restrictions. The U.S. is going to have to play it maybe at an even higher level and maybe make even more putts than they did at Whistling Straits to finally get that Ryder Cup on European soil.
Very well said, Kel. I don't know if they can make any more putts.
I don't know either.
Than they did at Whistling Straits. But having not won since 93, it may look like it's going to be easy on paper. But Henrik Stenson, he's a very astute individual, and he'll know how to motivate those guys. And I look for a real tussle when we get to Italy.
I do as well. Later in this, our second podcast, Bob, we're going to welcome a dear friend of mine, Johnny Holiday, a longtime voice of the University of Maryland basketball and football teams. guesstimated that Johnny has actually covered and aired more than 1,800 games for the men's basketball team and football team. Therefore, a lot of stories. Johnny's a great storyteller. But his fascinating guys, his extraordinary career really goes way beyond the football fields and basketball courts. So we're going to talk to Johnny about his years as a DJ and a very prominent one is that at that his involvement with what was the final concert for the ages and even a connection to one of the kind of the saddest times in the history of our country. I know I'm looking forward to talking to Johnny as are you, Bob.
I really am. He's a living legend. And just reading my prep work, I'm excited. I'm like a fan. Boy, I'm going to be having a nice conversation with Johnny Holiday, and I'm sure Musing on Sports listeners are going to enjoy it.
Bob, I also want to mention what's clearly been nothing short of a free agent frenzy in the National Football League. I grew up being a fan of the Washington Redskins, and particularly during their heyday in the 80s, the early 90s. Man, the NFC East back then, Bob, I mean, loaded with incredible players. You had Lawrence Taylor, who to me is the best defensive player I've personally ever seen play the game. Reggie White of the Eagles, John Riggins of the Redskins, Tony Dorsett of the Cowboys, Randall Cunningham, the quarterback for the Eagles. The NFC East, unlike today, was really the beast back then. Well, man, oh, man, you look at, you talk about the potential for dominance today, just in the past 2 weeks. Look at what's happened in the AFC West. You've had Russell Wilson. He's gone to Denver. Packers made the trade for Davante Adams, who is the best wide receiver in the game, and Aaron Rodgers no longer has his top target. Chargers trade to get the linebacker Khalil Mack from the Bears to go with a really potent offense that's powered by Justin Herbert, their young quarterback. And we haven't even mentioned the Kansas City Chiefs, who just acquired Juju Smith-Schuster, rather, to add to Pat Mahomes' passing corps. So it's really, really a heck of a division. One other thing, just as a little layer of stories on here, I mentioned about the 80s. In particular, what turned out to be a night of literally incredible pain. I was at that infamous Monday night game in 1985 at RFK Stadium with my dad when Lawrence Taylor, and he certainly didn't do it on purpose, but he broke Joe Theismann's leg. And you talk about a hush falling over the crowd that night. The play itself, if you ever watch it, was actually a flea flicker, which is where you hand off to the running back and then he flips it back to the quarterback before he gets to the line of scrimmage. It's always been my favorite play, and it's one that Joe Gibbs used effectively over his time in Washington. But Lawrence Taylor, Bob, oh, my God, he was not tricked. He was on Theismann in a heartbeat after Joe had eluded Harry Carson. And the next thing you know, LT's waving toward the Washington bench for their training staff to come because he knew instantly what had happened. But, in so many ways, Bob, great players make great plays. But, boy, that NFC East back in the day, much like what you could see with the AFC West today, was the place to be.
Yeah, it certainly was. And the NFL just seems to grow in popularity. And the more legalized betting sweeps this country, I only see the NFL getting bigger and bigger.
Well, it's always been one of the big reasons, one of the big attractions to the NFL. It's not that complicated, by the way, to bet. I mean, the line comes out. If somebody's a three-point favorite, you have a pretty good idea of how to do that. It's just a question of how much money you might want to be spending. We'll have one more topic to cover before we welcome in Johnny Holiday. But Bob, first, how about a word from our good friends at Titleist?
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Well, welcome back to Musings on Sports. Kelly Elbin here along with Bob Bubka. And Bob, I don't know how much hockey we're going to cover on Musings on Sports over time, but I got to tell you what, when the great Alex Ovechkin scored his 767th goal, a career goal last week to become third all-time in NHL history, I really got emotional. I grew up as a very passionate Caps fan, and like so many Capitals fans, it suffered through a just a string of devastating playoff losses, particularly to the Pittsburgh Penguins. I'll try not to say anything more about them. And then finally, it was June 7th, 2018. It's ingrained in my head. The Caps won their first and still their only Stanley Cup. And, of course, it was Alex, the team captain, who celebrated like no other after winning the championship, ending up in all kinds of crazy places and drinking a whole lot of beer and I'm sure vodka. And now he's the greatest European goal scorer in NHL history. He's passed Jaromir Jagr. And you just watch, Bob. He'll catch the great one, Wayne Gretzky. Gretzky's at 894. Do some quick math. Ovechkin needs about 120. He's just scored his 40th goal. I want to say sometime in the spring of 2025, the great eight was going to pass the great one to become the NHL's all-time goal scorer. And I understand you might have a story about number 99.
Well, I get a chuckle when you just say the name Wayne Gretzky. I go out to the Tiger tournament at Sherwood Country Club in California, and I remember the first time out there, I'm standing down at the first tee, and somebody says to me, you want to see where Vin Scully lives? And I said, sure. And they said, look up there to the left. And Wayne Gretzky has a house in that development also. And he says, you see Vince's house? I said, yes. He says, you see that house next door to Vin Scully? I said, yeah, it's a little bit bigger than Vince's. And person telling me the story says, yeah, well, that's the number one porn star in L.A. I said, you're kidding me. You mean Vin Scully has to drive home every night, pull into his driveway, and go past that house? But had an opportunity to spend a little bit of time with Wayne Gretzky. You know, he's the father of the lady that Dustin Johnson has been involved with, Paulina, for quite some time. And I saw Wayne once, and I said, Wayne, let me just ask you a quick question. I said, give me your philosophy when a fight broke out on the ice. He said, it was simple. I skated as fast and as hard as I could in the opposite direction. I didn't want any part of any fights. So Wayne Gretzky not only knew how to score the goal, he had a pretty good head on his shoulders.
Well, he really did. He had the likes of Marty McSorley, guys like that, who truly protected him. So, yeah, number 99 was smart in more ways than one. There's no question about it. We're going to be welcoming in our good friend Johnny Holiday in just a minute. But before we do that, let's hear from Bridgestone Golf.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
We're back on Musings on Sports, and we're delighted to welcome in our special guest. He's been a great friend for a long time, just completed his 43rd year as the voice of both the University of Maryland football and men's basketball teams. But I got to tell you, folks, there is so much more to the incredible story of the great Johnny Holiday. Johnny, welcome to Musings on Sports. Thanks so much for joining Bob Bupka and me.
Well, thank you. Appreciate the time. I appreciate you asking me to come on with your show, and I know it's going to be a very interesting conversation. I'll try to remember all the things we're going to touch on in the next few minutes.
Well, I know for one thing, you'll remember you've got a wealth of great stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. And Bob, kick it over to you. You know, there's so many ways we could start this time with Johnny, but I know you're interested in the Johnny Holiday, frankly, who made a name for himself way before, you know, he started calling games behind the mic in a little different situation behind the mic.
Well, you're right about that, Kelly, and it's a pleasure and an honor to speak to the one and only Johnny Holiday. Johnny, I remember you from so many years at ABC Radio. You covered the Masters, and at the Olympics you worked, you have a classic story about one of the all-time greats in broadcasting history. Can you share that with us?
Well, you're probably referring to the one with maybe Howard Cosell in Los Angeles.
That's it.
At the Olympics in Los Angeles. Cosell, when I would take my show to New York out of Washington every morning at 5:30, and Howard Cosell would tape his show right after mine, he'd be in his apartment in New York. And each day when I would finish my show, they would keep the line open, and he would have some comment about something I said or something dealing with what's going on in the world. So I got to know him fairly well. Not that we were good friends, but I had a Howard Cosell impersonation I did on the morning show when I was doing a morning show. And he was down in Washington one time to MC the muscular dystrophy banquet. And I was the MC and he was the guest speaker. So I asked him if I could introduce him as himself. And he said, well, if you'd like to make a total beep of yourself, go ahead. So I introduced him as Howard Cosell, and he comes up to the microphone and he says, I'd like to thank the diminutive one, Johnny Holiday, for that less than stellar introduction. And so fade to black in Los Angeles, I'm doing my show, and the engineer in New York says to me, have you seen Cosell? I say, he just walked in the arena. And I'm sitting ringside with Ken Norton, who's going to be the analyst for me. We're doing boxing on ABC Radio. So Cosell comes over. Hello, champ. And Norton says, how you doing, Howard? Hello, Johnny. How are you, my friend? I said, I'm doing good. Angel wants to know if you could do the show right now. I've got television to do. I've got commitments to do. Can I use your headset? I said, sure, go ahead, use the headset. All right, Angel, let's go. This is local. 3, 2, 1. Hello, everyone. Howard Cosell, the sports arena in Los Angeles. We're talking boxing with the American boxing team, blah, blah, blah. Back in a moment. He does one show, then he does the national show. He has no notes at all. Everything is off the top of his head. He takes the headset off, throws it down in front of me, and says, that's no way to do a show. And he walks away. And so I said, Angel, what was his time on the shows? He says, exactly 3 minutes. The local show was 3 minutes. I said, he had no notes. Amazing. Absolutely amazing guy.
Well, I got to tell you something, Johnny. I thought I was pretty versatile, but you've acted in 30 plays. You were even nominated for a Helen Hayes Award for Best Actor in Washington, D.C. Musical. Why acting? How did that start? Do you ever rest?
Well, I started the acting when I was in Cleveland. A guy asked me one night at a party I went to, and he was the producer of a summer series at Kane Park Music Theater, and they would bring in big-name acts to do musicals in the summertime. And they had Dion come in, they had Bobby Vinton come in, they had Paul Peterson come in, and they all did musicals, and they did Finian's Rainbow, and they did Oklahoma. So the gentleman asked me, he said, have you ever done any acting? I said, well, in high school, that's all. Just, you know, I did it because it was an easy subject, and all the guys that played sports we like to take easy subjects. So he said, well, I think I've got a role for you in Finian's Rainbow, Og the Leprechaun. Okay. And I'm bringing in a girl named Jenny Smith. She's the singer on the Steve Allen Tonight Show on television. Mm. And she's going to play the lead. So when I did the show, I was on 3 o'clock to 7 in the afternoon on WHK in Cleveland. And I would promote the fact that I'll see you at Kane Park Theater tonight. Curtain time is 8:30 for Finian's Rainbow. And I was amazed the number of people that had seen the show. And I realized this is a great way to promote myself and to promote the radio station and to get more listeners. So that's when I started doing theater in 1963, I guess it was, in Cleveland. And since that time, I've had just wonderful roles, wonderful roles. Music Man, Harold Hill, Bye Bye Birdie, the Dick Van Dyke role, 42nd Street, Julian Marsh, the producer, the same time next year, The Odd Couple. I mean, the list goes on and on. Being My Girl was one of my favorites. And I haven't done a show now in probably 15 years because baseball took up all the time that I would normally do a show from April through September. But then with baseball, I had to give it up. But I miss it, and I had a wonderful time doing it.
Well, Johnny, so much versatility that that Bob mentioned. And it all really started for you as a DJ. And I'm wondering if you could, through your book From Rock to Jock, you talked about so much that's happened in your career. Your work as a DJ was a massive part of that. I wonder if you could, before we get into a really historic concert that you were involved in your days in San Francisco, you were also involved in what had to have been the strangest football game you were ever part of on November 24th, 1963, and wondering again how that came to be through your involvement as a DJ.
Well, that was the tragic day that President Kennedy got assassinated in a couple of days earlier in Dallas, and the Cowboys were in Cleveland to play the Browns, and I happened to be the public address announcer for the Cleveland Browns. And so everybody was up in arms. The entire city was explain or describe the anger they had over just the city of Dallas and what took place. So Art Modell, who owned the team at that time, asked me, he told me, I'd like to have you make sure that you never use the word Dallas during the game, because that is going to elicit boos and who knows what else could happen. Just refer to them as Cowboys or figure out some other way to call the game without mentioning Dallas. And I said, sure, Mr. Modell, be glad to be happy to do that for you. No problem at all. But it was a problem because automatically when you're doing the public address announcing, you're going to say, first down Dallas or first down for the Cowboys. And you kind of alternate throughout the game, ball at the Dallas 22. I couldn't use the word at all. Probably one of the toughest things I ever had to do, but I did it. I got through the entire game and never mentioned the word Dallas. It was always Cowboys a couple of times. I think yeah. I threw in a couple of times, a Cleveland ball on the opposition 24-yard line. it was tough. It was really, really tough. But I did it and got through it. But that's the most unusual game I think I've ever done.
And, Johnny, that had to have been a very eerie experience that day. You're talking literally 2 days removed from the president being assassinated, and Pete Rozelle had made the decision to go forward with games. It had to have been just almost a bizarre scene there.
Yeah, I think everybody was shocked that they played. I'm not sure if I would have done that, but I guess they felt that, trying to keep things as normal as possible. And the one city that was the target, I think, of everybody in the country was looking at what's it going to be like in Cleveland, because Dallas is in Cleveland for that game and they're going to play it. And, are there going to be problems? Is there going to be people demonstrate what's going to go on. But they did it, and there was, from what I can recall, there was no problems whatsoever. It was just a very, very low-key crowd. It was almost similar to when Ernie Davis got introduced, the great Syracuse running back who never played a down for the Browns because he had been hit with leukemia and he passed away. And the night that he walked through the goalpost during an exhibition game to be introduced but never put on a uniform, that was probably something very close to what happened with this game with Dallas. But it was a very eerie, uncomfortable situation.
Now, on a much brighter and really what I had to have been a much louder note, you went from Cleveland. Eventually, you as a disc jockey found your way to a big role in San Francisco in that market. Tell us how you got involved in what turned out to be the Beatles' final concert. When did you start your gig behind the mic in San Francisco, and what led to you being, you know, so up close with the Fab Four in their final live performance?
I had met the guys when I was in New York. I went from Cleveland to New York City for a short time on 1010 Winds. And so Murray Decay was the big guy on that station on 1010 Winds. And my first day in New York, I had to do my show and his show. He was in Miami Beach. Excuse me. He was in Miami Beach with the Beatles. And they would call in every night, and I'd pop them on the air with me and talk with them. And so I'd had a little conversation back and forth with these guys. And so then when the station went to All News in New York, I accepted a job in San Francisco at KYA. And we sponsored the Beatles concert at Candlestick Park. And nobody knew it was the last concert of them together in public. Tickets were $6.50. That was the top ticket. It wasn't sold out. And the thing I remember most was being in the Giants clubhouse with the guys sitting around talking just like we're talking right now, with sandwiches and snacks and drinks on the table in front of us, and there are people walking around and nobody doing any picture taking and no autographs, nothing like that. And then time for them to go on stage, and they had an armored car that they would get into under the stands, and the armored car would go out, and they got out at second base on this elevated stage, and there were maybe 25,000 people there to see the concert. It wasn't sold out on a cold night in August, and they did maybe 40 minutes, got back in the armored car, back underneath the stadium, got their stuff, off to the airport, flew back to Los Angeles. That was it for the Beatles, with in-person concerts together as those four guys.
Johnny, I don't get it. How could that concert, it was the Beatles, how could it not have been sold out?
I think Kelly, that, you know, the music had changed at that point a little bit. It was starting to change with the long album cuts with Moby Grape and Every Mother's Son and Janis Joplin and Grace Slick in the Airplane. Hmm. And, you know, the longer cuts in the albums and the FM. And the psychedelic stuff was kind of moving in at that time. And if you remember, the Beatles had kind of pushed Motown off the charts. When they came on the scene, it was a phenomenon that people couldn't believe these four guys. Then more English acts started coming over. But I think that's probably the reason why that they probably got bigger later on than they were at that particular time. I don't have any answer for you, to be honest with you. But the tickets, can you imagine paying $6.50 to see the Beatles? Are you kidding me?
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And it was a cold night. It's mind-boggling why it wasn't completely sold out, but it wasn't.
Hey, Johnny, one thing I've been dying to ask, and I want to remind our listeners to Musing on Sports, we got the legendary Johnny Holiday on with us, and I know you had an opportunity to do some pregame shows with Ted Williams when he was the manager of the Washington Senators, and then you landed behind the mic calling games for University of Maryland. We know how well that worked out. What was Ted Williams like?
Like John Wayne, like visiting with John Wayne. That's the best analogy I can make between what was Ted Williams like. He, to me, was intimidating. You know, he was 6'4". Here I am, 5'8", 145 pounds, soaking wet. And but he was always nice. He was always gracious. And there's one story I love to tell about Ted Williams that if my father was around, he would go nuts with this story. I had a charity softball team and a charity basketball team. And the slow pitch, and we would play different organizations and give them all the money. So we have a doubleheader one night. And so we'd already done Ted Williams' pregame show. And I'm sitting in the dugout talking to some guys, Tim Cullen, Bernie Allen, Dick Bosman, who was on that ball club. And so Ted Williams walks out, and I'm at the end of the dugout, and he says, "Hey, Holiday, how was that? How'd you do in that doubleheader last night?" I said, "Well, I think I probably went maybe 8 for 15. And he says, "In slow pitch?"
Oh, boy.
Grab a bat. Let me see your stats. So I grab a bat. And I'm showing him my, here. And he bats from the left side, right? So he's crouching down in that familiar Ted Williams stance. He's got the bat cocked back over his left shoulder. He said, "You're not putting your, take a swing. You're not putting your hips, you got to put your hips into it, Johnny." And I'm thinking, man, if somebody was videoing this, this is the classic. Ted Williams giving little Johnny Holiday a hitting instruction after a slow pitch doubleheader.
Oh, Johnny. You know, you've been calling Maryland football and men's basketball games now for 43 years. I'm no rocket scientist. That's about 1,800 games. You're in the Washington, D.C. Sports Hall of Fame. You were doing voiceover commercials yesterday. What continues to motivate Johnny Holiday?
I don't think it's motivation. I think it's more, I just love what I do. I like every aspect of everything I've been lucky to do over all these years. And sometimes people will say to me, "What do you like best, football or basketball or baseball or golf or boxing or Olympics, whatever?" And my answer is always, I like whatever sport I'm doing at that time. I give each one the same amount of attention. I don't think you can slack off from anything. It's like when Maryland's playing a non-conference game and they're favored by 40 points, I take that game as seriously as I do if they're playing a Michigan, if they're playing a Michigan State, or if they're playing a Duke when they were in the ACC. I don't think you can take any time off at all for preparation and stuff like that. And I think, Bob, when I go back and think of all the things that I've been fortunate to do in 62 years in this business, that it's a privilege to do what I do. It's not rocket science. It's not brain surgery. It's not heavy lifting. It's just something I've been fortunate to have a gift for. And I try to do it the best that I can. And you're not going to please everybody. There's going to be critics no matter what you're doing. But I try to please most of the people most of the time. I'm not there to criticize. I'm not there to second guess a team. I'm there to call the game. The analysts can do that. They can, you know, pick somebody apart or take a shot or criticize or critique. But I'm not going to do that. And sometimes when I'm doing a Maryland game, a lot of people have said to me in the past, "You know, we know you're the Maryland guy, but you always give the other team credit." I said, "Well, you have to. If the other team has got a 50-point lead, they're doing something right and you're doing something wrong. If the guy's having 35 or 40 points in a game, you've got to point that out. You can't sugarcoat it and you can't hide it." So I try to be as honest as I can. And I've been, first of all, I've been very, very lucky. There's a lot of luck involved in broadcasting, not how good you are, not what kind of a voice you have or all these other things that people say, you got to have this to be on the radio, but you have to have this for television. No, you don't either. You got to have a lot of luck too, in the right place at the right time. And somebody gives you that opportunity, you've got to take advantage of it.
Well, John, Bob mentioned about you doing some voiceovers for commercials yesterday. As we tape this, you're going to be introducing Kevin Willard as the new Maryland men's basketball coach today. If you would, looking back at sort of a greatest moment, some thoughts that come to mind, both maybe a greatest moment in calling a game for you and maybe a greatest moment in broadcasting for you away from sports.
I think probably the greatest game, Kelly, without question, would have to be the national championship win over Indiana in April of 2002 in Atlanta. Maryland had never won the national championship in men's basketball. They had won at that time, I think, only two or three ACC championships together. And to go down there and to come away with a win on the biggest stage in the country, the Final Four, and to bring that championship back to Maryland, that without question is the one that I will always put on top of my list. I think also any time that when Maryland was in the ACC, the big wins over Duke were always special, and North Carolina always special. And the games that I did with Lynn Bias when he was playing at Maryland and tragically lost his life with cocaine ingestion the day after he got drafted by the Boston Celtics. And to know the kid like I did and the effect it had on the Maryland basketball program, and in fact, the entire athletic program for years, that death just rocked the entire community and the entire nation. And I think when I think of things not related to sports, one of the biggest thrills of my life was being the announcer for This Week with David Brinkley on ABC television. The voiceover guy. And then with This Week with Sam and Cokie on ABC television. And you don't find many guys that do sports that are also announcers for news shows. It doesn't really match up. But I think I learned a long time ago to take advice and direction from directors and give them what they want. If they want a hard sell, I can give them a hard sell approach. If they want a softer sell, I give them a softer sell approach. And if you can do that, you've got a nice long, you got longevity in the business if you can adjust to what other people want you to do. Then I think in theater, the Helen Hayes Award or nomination was a highlight of my life because I'm not a professional actor. But I saw something that I knew I could sing. I knew I could dance. I knew I could memorize lines. And I knew I could do different roles, and every role that I wanted to do, I've been able to do. How to Succeed in Business. I loved the Bobby Morse role. I did that. Julian Marsh in 42nd Street. I did that. Just so many different things. It's hard to nail down maybe one or two things that have really stood out for me. I've been very fortunate. That's all. And I knock on wood of how grateful I am for all the things that I've been able to do, some well, some better than others, and maybe some in people's eyes not quite as good as they thought it should have been. But I'm very fortunate.
Well, in my eyes, Johnny Holiday, as good gets. It's been a delight to look back at all of your great work. And as Kelly mentioned, you're starting to get ready for season number 44. Thanks so much for joining Musings on Sports.
Bob, what a treat to have had Johnny Holiday on. He is a special guy in so many ways, so far beyond the athletic fields and basketball courts.
You know, I've had the pleasure and great pride in interviewing a lot of people. The depth of knowledge of Johnny Holiday on so many various fronts was incredible to me. And I guarantee you, all listeners on Musing on Sports, they're not only going to enjoy it, they're going to be telling their friends, hey, you want to listen to Kelly Elbin, Bob Bupka, they got Johnny Holiday on. What a guy he is.
No, you're absolutely right. And Bob, we're two down. Many, many more to go with Musings on Sports. It's been a whole lot of fun. Continue to listen, everybody, to Musings on Sports. It's Kelly Elbin signing off along with Bob Bupka.